Saxon Codpiece.
You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend.
Welcome back, friends. Please make sure your pod seat and tray table are in their upright and locked position, the airlock is sealed, and the docking clamps have been released for an on-time departure to the Functional Nerdverse. I'm very psyched because today we have a fun guest who is new to me in the sense that I've never had the opportunity to corner him and chat with him before, but goes way back with Patrick. This is the author of the Seven Kenning series, the Iron Druid series, co-author with Delilah Dawson of the Tales of Pell. We've got Kevin Hearn. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Tracy. Thanks so much for having me on. It's wonderful to meet you.
Yeah, this seems like just a variation on the theme of meeting in the COVID times, but you know, we're just less on the Zoom and more on the noise.
Yeah, for sure. So someday we'll be in the other end of this.
I've told Kevin this in the past, but as much as I love the Iron Druid, and I do love the Iron Druid, the Tales of Pell is absolutely one of my favorite series. I reread that. I re-listen to it on audio because it just cracks me up so much. It's so much fun.
Thank you so much. And Delilah will be delighted to hear that as well because
I've told her too. Yes,
we had a blast writing those. They, you can kind of tell when you read them how much fun we were having.
Oh, it definitely comes through.
Oh yeah.
There's a Chicago local con. I'm in the Chicago area, Kevin. Called Capricorn, and it happens in February because Capricorn. they have a long running panel that I've attended before, but I had the opportunity to be on the panel for the first time last year, which was fun. The panel is called Judging a Book from Page 128. And just like it says on the tin, the notion is the panelists come up with a bunch of books that they've like wrapped in butcher paper or whatever so that the audience can't tell physically what they're holding, or maybe they've got it on a Kindle or whatnot. Uh-huh. And they go to page 128 of a book, or if that's like an end paper or something weird, something nearby it, and they read about a page and a half or so from 128 on out loud to the audience. And the audience then votes as to whether, based on that sample, they would read that book, what they liked about it, what they disliked about it. And the audience just sort of takes over from there. And then there's a big reveal of what the book was. And last time I was at this panel and I was on the panel, one of the co-panelists ended up choosing Kill the Farm Boy. So you'll be pleased to know that there was unanimous agreement in the audience based on the strength of page 128 in Kill the Farm Boy that they wanted to read it.
Oh my gosh. Now I'm curious what was on that page, but that's great.
I guess you're going to have to look.
I'll make a note to myself.
It was hardback, if that makes any difference. It was a hardback.
Oh, actually it does, I think.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you this. I mean, as great as those books are, believe me, they're just incredible. The audiobooks, oh my God. That's Luke Daniels again, right?
Yes, it is.
Doing those? He is so freaking talented.
Yes.
My goodness. He comes up with so many the voices just for the goat. Oh my God. he's so good and he cracks me up. So, you know, the performance on those audiobooks, well worth it. Whatever your audiobook platform that you prefer out there, listeners, go grab those books. My goodness.
Yeah. One of the things about Luke that I've always enjoyed and then Delilah discovered as well is that even though we're extremely familiar with the story, when we listen to it, his performance of it always catches us by surprise and we wind up laughing at our own stuff. And we didn't think, you know, we could be surprised anymore because after all, we came up with it. But still, you know, it's his delivery is so remarkable that he really brings a lot to the table. So
he does. Yeah. Who I don't know who found him for the Iron Druid but whoever did, you need to buy him a drink.
Yeah. It was Brilliance Audio. They were at the time a company based in Michigan, and that's where Luke lives. And so he was kind of one of their local boys and local talent that they hired on. And so it was sheer luck that I got him to start with. But then, you know, once I did, I'm like, he will be recording all of my stuff forever. Thank you.
Yeah. Cause again, an incredible voice performance in the Iron Druid series, you know, the Oberon, for example, like I've talked to you about this before, Oberon just kills me every single time. And that's, you know, thanks to Luke and the voice that he developed for that character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, this might be a weird thing. I think because of it, well, it's entirely because of Luke. I'm in this weird situation where I actually sell more audiobooks than I do paper or ebook because his performance is so popular with readers. Mm-hmm. You know, they might start out with a print version, but then once they go to audio and give it a try, they're like, oh, yeah, this is the way to enjoy these. Yeah.
Yeah. There's some real value added here.
Yeah, for sure.
I tell everybody to get them. I do.
Thank you.
Just because I love them so much. And I love the little shorts that you've done with Oberon, the Oberon Murder Mysteries.
Yeah.
Those have been fantastic, too.
You know, I've got a short coming out that Luke will be doing, too, that'll be coming out in January. And it's called A Question of Navigation. And it's my first science fiction foray. Ooh. So it's a novella with Subterranean Press, but Luke and I are going to be doing the audiobook together. And nice. It starts out in the Rocky Mountain National Park there, Patrick. So you might be amused by that. But yeah, I'm excited to see that because, of course, you know, whenever I try something and I try to be serious about it, it'll wind up being at least partially funny anyway. So A Question of Navigation is partially a little bit campy horror and then, you know, partially just flat out funny. And I hope folks like it. I had a lot of fun writing it.
That sounds great, Tracy.
After listening to all of the Iron Druid and the side mysteries and stuff, I started developing my own take on Oberon's voice, and I was doing that quite a bit, and I even annoyed Kevin with it. But I even put something on Twitter, and Luke was like, "Oh my god, I want to hear it. I want to hear your version of Oberon." I'm like, "Okay," and so I recorded it and sent it to him. He's like.
He's like, well,
yeah, that's nice.
Trying.
Yeah, there's a lot of different ways to. I mean, people ask me sometimes, "Is that the way you hear Oberon when you're writing?" And no, it's not.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
And that's fine. You know, one of the things is that audio is, of course, a performance art, mm-hmm. and the performance of anything written is always going to be different. It's a different genre, you know?
Sure.
So yeah. I appreciate what he's bringing to the table there. And it's not the way that I think of it in my head, but neither is Oberon is not the same in anybody's head when they're reading it. So
no.
Yeah. Well, why should it be? No.
All right. Right.
And I mean, we do need to bring it back to the fact that it's still your words. It's still your characters. It's still, you know, that's you in there.
Absolutely.
Creating all that. He's just doing a performance of it. He's doing a fantastic job with the performance. That's my point. You know, but the books I think stand on their own just as awesome as it is. Anyway.
Well, thank you.
So enough kind of us buttering Kevin up. Go for it.
Now we get into the real tough questions. I have to ask, because this is actually a question that's been tumbling around in my mind for a while. I was like, oh, if I'm ever at a con or something and end up, you know, standing near Kevin Hearn in the bar, maybe I'll ask him about this. And thus far, this hasn't happened. So now we have you as a captive audience. And so I feel compelled to ask, when I was growing up, one of my absolute favorite series of books that I read in elementary school age was James Howe's Bunnicula books. I don't know if you're familiar, Kevin.
I'm not, unfortunately. I'm sorry.
Oh, well, never mind. That completely tanks my theory. I had this very thoroughly developed theory that Harold, who is the dog narrator of the books and is often involved in the investigation of mysteries, had some evolutionary connection to Oberon. So never mind. My fan theory is tanked. That's fine. But tanking that fan theory about one series gives us, I think, a pretty good in for talking about your latest from August, Ink and Sigil.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I wound up basically writing this one short story while I was doing the Iron Druid Chronicles. And it was in the collection of short stories that came out as a book, and it's called Besieged. And there's this one little character who shows up in this one short story, and he's just described dismissively as the Scottish wizard, but his presence in this story, and he says, I think, two sentences. but he's so strangely out of place in that story. And I found him really compelling when once I thought, you know, well, what's this guy's backstory and what's he do? Why was he there? And you know, what is a Scottish wizard anyway? And what, and so on. So once I started thinking about all that, I started to have a lot of fun coming up with who he was and what was his magic system and how it was complementary. Like, what was he doing in the Iron Druid universe? And I found that actually a lot more compelling as a writer to pursue than maybe some of the other obvious choices that I had. You know, I could have followed the werewolves or the vampires, mm-hmm. Or the Polish coven, things like that, that people might have expecting, or even followed up with different druids, you know, Granuel or Owen. But I wound up going with Aloysius McVarish, and he is a master of ink magic, basically, and sigils. That and the way I worked it in to the magic system of the Iron Druid was that Briad needed somebody to attend to Fae priorities while Atticus was basically AWOL. He was gone for so long, or hiding for so long, and not really doing much of what he needed to do as a druid, and she needed to get stuff done. So she came up with sigil agents. They could basically use magical inks to perform some basic bindings and get things done without becoming full druids. And so that was her workaround, basically. So now there's 5 sigil agents in the world, and Al McVarish is in Glasgow, Scotland. And then the other, there's one in the United States, one in Taiwan, or I'm sorry, there's 2 based in the United States, one in Taiwan and one in Australia, down in Melbourne. So there you go. That's kind of where I wound up coming up with this entirely new but complementary magic system, and telling a different set of stories from the druids. So, but all of the characters from the Iron Druid universe can and possibly will show up throughout the series. So, yeah, so I've got. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh no! Oh yeah. What I was gonna say is one of the things that I've always found sort of interesting and exciting about your writing is the way it kind of interfaces with that ongoing argument for people who write fantasy and who read it about whether or not magic should have limits or rules, and what those rules and what that looks like is. So of course, obviously, we have the metallurgy based system of the Iron Druid, and now in the case of Al, let's not bury the lead here. That Al enjoys is the wrong word. Experiences a certain set of consequences as a result of or trade off with his ability to command magic through sigils. And so I get excited about this sort of thing because it seems like creating these hurdles for your characters and these sort of resources that they need or burdens that they bear becomes such a wonderful way of cracking open stories for them and kind of making story just happen on its own. Like what everyday things become so much more difficult if you are a terribly powerful person who at the same time can't, well, in the case of Al, talk out loud without significant consequences.
Yeah. Yeah. He was basically in the course of his duty somewhere because he is basically supposed to write and enforce magical contracts. He winds up being disliked by quite a few potent personages, mm-hmm. he said with alliteration. And so he winds up getting cursed, but he doesn't know who did it. And he's also doubly cursed, and he only finds that out as he goes. So, he's basically figured out that if he speaks too long to somebody, they will eventually begin to harbor a deep dislike for him, like, you know, crossing into hatred and wanting to do him physical harm if they even, you know, see him around. And unfortunately, that, you know, he found that out first with members of his family, you know, the people that he spoke to the most. And so once he figured out what was happening, it wasn't just that he was a jerk, you know, there was more to it. There was actually a curse going on. He figured out, I have to work around this. If I want to have a relationship with anybody, I need to basically use a text to speech app on my phone or on a laptop, one or the other. So getting into that research and doing that was kind of interesting. It's you know, obviously a, you know, a, an issue that many people need to deal with. And what's available out there varies widely. What's available for free is pretty, you know, you get what you pay for. But there's some truly remarkable text-to-speech apps out there now, you know, if you're willing to pay for them. And if you do need them, you know, then it's certainly worth it. They have a range of accents available for all different kinds of English around the world. And then, of course, they have other languages as well. So it's fantastic what's available. So Al has to overcome that and deal with that little issue and then realize that he has some more issues on top of it as he goes.
Right. It's so interesting because, in essence, this curse has constructed a kind of disability for him. I mean, he can speak, but the consequences for doing it are probably more than he wants to deal with or wants to risk at any given time. And so it really does hamper his day-to-day life.
Yeah. All right. That's a good way of putting it. It is not technically a disability, but it is something that does affect how he, you know, exists in the world. So he has to find some workarounds, and he becomes a little bit more empathetic, perhaps, for people who have to have, you know, different workarounds for whatever disabilities they may have. Mm-hmm. That's one thing that I was wanting to kind of explore a little bit in a character. And then I had some other issues too. I often wind up having some sort of social issue that I'm kind of addressing through the plot a little bit. And in this particular case, it was human trafficking. So. I have that kind of broken down for by a character named Saxon Codpiece.
Oh, good lord.
Yeah. Yeah, that name is one of my favorite things. We actually came up with it at San Diego Comic-Con years and years ago. Me and my editors, we were trying to think of what would be the most ridiculous sounding English name possible. Mm-hmm. And we came up with Saxon Codpiece. And
which works so much better when you say it like that. Yeah.
Well, and that's the way you're supposed to kind of say it. There, right. You know, like he wants you to say it like there's an exclamation point after each name. And he makes him sound heroic, like he's a superhero, you know. Saxon Codpiece.
You're clearly a writer who takes so much joy in what you do. So I gotta ask, because it's something that when I am working on my own writing that I sometimes struggle with. How do you balance enjoying your stories and loving your characters with knowing that, like, you've got to do awful shit to them to make plot happen? Like, you've got to really make their lives difficult, sometimes in amusing ways, but sometimes in really authentically painful ways. How do you find the joy in essentially trolling these people who you've created for the sake of enduring a kind of theatrical torture?
Well, I do it because I love them and I want them to grow.
That's harder on me than it is on you, Saxon Codpiece.
That's honestly what it is, you know, that I want them to be better. And they can't get any better if they're never challenged. And I don't look at it as like, you know, they're going to be tortured necessarily. It's, you know, I might just gently pat the laptop there and say, there, you'll be better later. Just wait.
We'll get a couple chapters.
Yeah. We'll turn things around a little bit later on after you've had a revelation or an epiphany of some sort. But you're going to go through some stuff first. So, that's the way I sort of kind of approach it. Of course, sometimes there's not a happy ending for certain characters, but, and you're like, well, how do they grow if they're dead? You know? But at the same time, those kinds of events in our life, one of the recurring themes in a lot of my works across all of my series is how do you deal with grief? Mm-hmm. So especially in the Seven Kenning series, I got quite a string of that going on because people are dealing with the aftermath of a war in which there are quite a number of casualties and innocent lives lost. So how do people deal with that and rebuild is something that gets explored in that series quite a bit too. So, then of course, not just grief over death, but there's all kinds of, there's PTSD of varying kinds that you have to deal with. So, That's something as well as, that I try to take a look at. But I do it so that you know, the characters are hopefully going to be better people at the on the other end of the book.
I guess to some extent, better them than us. Like if part of the function, it was Horace who claimed that the function of literature is to delight and instruct. And if on some level the things that delight us can also make us sort of sit back and be like, well, I've seen Atticus grow in this way. I've seen these characters change in this way. So maybe me too.
I hope so. You know what's fascinating to me as a writer is occasionally coming across a tweet where somebody is discussing the work as an example of this particular philosophy or idea or something like that, which was not anywhere near what I was thinking or intending when I wrote it. Whenever that happens, I'm always fascinated by the different things that people see in my work, or other people's work. Right. So, one that just happened a couple of days ago was somebody was tweeting about how the Iron Druid Chronicles is a subtle manifesto on proto-anarchism. And I was like, I don't even know what that is.
Like, what are those words?
what's going on here? And I was like, if it's a subtle manifesto, it's so subtle, I didn't even know I was doing it. And I'd never even heard of proto-anarchism before. So I started to look it up and like, what does this guy think I'm doing? And it was kind of fascinating, you know? So once I looked it up and everything, I was like, all right, fine, sure. Okay. And it was unconsciously done. But I guess he's got a point about the subtext of the stories. So I always think that that's a fascinating thing. And I'm so happy that that's happening all the time with everybody's books, that people are finding new ways to, they're coming to it, bringing their own experiences and taking their own things away. And we're all growing because of it. Reading is the best.
And I think to some extent, like that whole delight and instruct thing, like sometimes it's just us instructing ourselves. Like when we're readers, like we see in the text something that our brain highlights because deep down inside it matters to us. And it's our brain sort of, I think, nudging us and signaling us like, hey, that thing that has been eating at you or bothering you or playing on your conscience or in your memory. See this thing right here? And I think that may be where the sort of like anarcho-syndicalist collective reading kind of thing comes from, that it's we're choosing how the book speaks to us, even if it means that we're kind of inserting words in a sense that are metaphorically not there.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. That's and one of the fun things too about like I used to be an English teacher, at some point when you're teaching English and whatever literature you're analyzing, pick anything, at some point somebody will ask, did the author really intend this? And waiting for them to say, it's like, we don't care what the author intended, because what we're doing is constructing meaning as readers. And that's the mental exercise here and the skill that you need to bring to it. And also the enjoyment of reading, period. So that's always a great discovery for everyone when they realize that you get to construct a lot of the reading and take away what you want to take away.
Yeah. Oh, my sweet summer child, let me tell you about the concept of the death of the author and the reason why J.K. Rowling really needs to stop telling us things from a series that ended 15 years ago. There is something very real, I think, to be said about. It's kind of like parallel processing, right? That we as writers are acknowledging that we have certain ideas in our minds and certain intent, and we put it down. And then you fling the text out into the world, and you either are the sort of writer who tortures yourself with Goodreads reviews and sort of checking in on your own status in the universe, or you know better and you stay away.
Yeah, that's me, the second one. Yeah.
No, it took me a while with mine to learn that lesson. I spent the first probably year after my first book came out lingering and malingering until I realized whatever endorphin rush you think this is going to give you is not going to manifest itself. Not because the reviews weren't by and large good, but because for like every 10 really positive reviews you get, the one who's like, meh, is the only one you remember. But that parallel processing of I know what I'm doing, or I hope I know what I'm doing, and then you make the thing and you send it out into the world. And then we as readers go and read stuff and refuel ourselves and derive our own sense of meanings while at the same time kind of compartmentalizing and going like, but this is probably me. This is not necessarily what this other author is striving towards. Got to kind of inhabit both those spaces at once.
But part of the problem with online reviews and is basically people don't go online to tell you how great you are. So you're going to see an overwhelming number of, oh my God, this sucks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So why put yourself through that torture? Mm-hmm. Because I have a really great experience with a company or an author or a book or something. Like I don't, oh my God, I got to get online and I got to just tell the world how great. That's like the problem, right? That's what authors are constantly going, look, if you want to help me and you love what I did, go online and say something about it. And very few people do. Mm-hmm. But you don't like something because of this weird social media internet thing that we have created, this monster that is, you know, the wall between you and everybody else. You have no qualms whatsoever about going online and saying, this is fucking bullshit. I hate this.
Yeah.
Fuck all of you. This is terrible. Blah, 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 blah.
Right.
And that happens all the time.
Yeah, it does.
So if you want to drive yourself nuts, yeah, go read the reviews.
Yeah. I definitely do not read my reviews, but I'm very thankful for the occasional reader who will do a flyby email and say, hey, Kevin, just wanted to let you know I just finished one series or another or whatever and really enjoyed it and it meant a lot to me, whatever. So it could take like two or three sentences, but it totally made my day and sometimes my week. Mm-hmm. And so I really appreciate folks who do that. It's super kind of them, you know. So it is.
I wish that more people did that.
Yeah,
I really do. I wish that people felt comfortable doing that. I think there's something just ingrained in us about giving compliments or receiving compliments.
Yeah, I mean, and it's a simple thing. I mean, I'll encourage anybody who's listening, you know, if there's an author's work that you've enjoyed, they usually have a public email address. Emailing them to contact form or something, and just emailing them a couple of lines to say, man, I really liked this book that you wrote and, you know, it spoke to me and thank you for writing it. That very simple thing is just going to really make their day. And it's just the second best thing you can do next to actually telling somebody else to go buy the book because you loved it. You know what I mean? The word of mouth is fantastic, but you know, those little tiny notes mean a lot.
And they have an uncanny timing. They always seem to turn up in your inbox at the darkest hour. I mean, maybe that's the reason why we keep writing stories the way we do. We're at like the darkest hour, the deus ex emotional machina emerges that helps the character rally themselves. Because we've had those experiences ourselves where we open the inbox and we go like, oh, I was totally not going to write today because everything is a dumpster fire floating down a river. But today I will do it for you. Rando person who said a nice.
Yeah.
And the river was on fire too, by the way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there was oil in the river because, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those little letters, they can kind of appear over, you know, the top of the hill like a Gandalf at dawn. You know, when things are darkest, here comes Gandalf and he's got, you know, the Rohirrim with him. And, you know, that letter kind of functions like that and really turns everything around for you. So,
oh my God, surely you've seen it, but it makes me think of all the memes that were playing out over the last, you know, 5, 6, 7 days on the interwebs. And of course, particularly fueled by American anxiety so many people were taking the great rallying scene from Avengers Endgame, where various characters have been de-Thanos'd, de-snapped, and show back up, and, like putting in heads over them and labeling them as states. Like, here comes Georgia, and here comes we're suckers for the come from behind narrative, especially I think when it rewards our own work.
I haven't seen that, but Kevin brought to mind something that I did see. It's a little meme and it says, did you know that originally Betty White was Betty Gray? She only became Betty White after she defeated the Balrog in battle.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I have never heard that before, but that's wonderful.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty cool.
My nerd trivia is that Gandalf actually means white wizard in Old Norse.
Oh
wow.
That it was or white elf, one or the other, but it was a basically a language pun or a joke that Tolkien built in.
It's a slow walk joke right there.
Yeah, it is. You know, he's like, I'm Gandalf the Grey, you know, when his name is really literally translates to I'm the White Wizard, the Grey. Okay.
Nice.
So, yeah, it was always a joke with him who Gandalf was going to be later on down the road. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, there you go. Yeah,
I will.
Super nerdy trivia.
I love it when writers do stuff like that. There, I just saw this thing because you remember the show How I Met Your Mother?
Yeah.
So apparently the writers worked in a long form gag that went over seasons. Okay. Where Barney, every time you saw Barney eating with chopsticks, he couldn't do it. He was, and it was just a throwaway thing. Like you would see the gang sitting around eating and there would just be a shot of Barney struggling and not being able to eat with chopsticks. Mm-hmm. But it was actually a setup. He was slowly putting in the gang's mind his incompetence with chopsticks, until the moment when he also secretly went and learned how to do the hibachi style of cooking at the restaurant.
Yeah.
With all the knives and the flipping and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And it was this long form thing that went over seasons until he finally made a bet with Marshall and Lily that he could do that form of cooking and he could do the shrimp in the pocket. I think it was what it was called or something.
Oh yeah.
And then suddenly shows off that, and he reaches in with his chopsticks and he takes some food and he eats it. And that's the first time you ever notice he actually knows how to use the chopsticks. It was this long form gag that they did, very similar to what you're talking about with Tolkien. But they decided in the first season they were going to do this in like season 5, and they just sprinkled it in over episodes for 5 seasons before they did the final gag.
I love that bit. I love stuff like that. I did the same thing with the Iron Druid Chronicles. I had this long running gag about you never want to be Nigel in Toronto. And then I didn't explain it until book 7.
Yeah.
And then I also had another running gag of you know, people wondering, do vampires poop? And yeah. I answered that in book 8, you know, but
I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. I love stuff like that.
Wasn't it Granuel actually asked him?
Yeah.
Or like that was like a condition of doing something. Like he had to answer that question.
Right. Cause he kept walking away before and never answering. Yep. And then, so she's like, well, if you want this from me, then you're going to have to finally answer this question. So yeah, that was great.
Maybe misremembering this, maybe from Harry Harrison's Stainless Steel Rats book, books, plural. But there's a long running, SF series. I mean, it's been finished for a long time now that my father-in-law used to read.
Yeah.
And, it's set up gag. And it was one character would say to another character, when they would meet someone mutually together, they were sort of like, you know, old bro friends with each other. They would meet a new mutual person, and one character A would offer to tell the story of the wee spotted snakes, and character B would be like, I'm literally going to kill you if you tell the story of the wee spotted snakes. Like, I never want to hear that again. And this goes on for books and books, where character A is always threatening to tell the story of the wee spotted snakes, and character B has this sort of over-the-top reaction. And unlike the examples that you're talking about, eventually when the story of the wee spotted snakes comes out, it's deeply disappointing how not very funny it is and how not very. And I couldn't help but think to myself, like, you probably should have just held that one closer to your chest and just let it go. So I think the fan fiction of what the wee spotted snakes were would have been so much more satisfying.
Yeah. I did a couple of those where I had running jokes or running, you know, references to things. And I purposely never explained them. Because I kind of feel that should be a thing too. That yeah. You know, you should allow some doubt about certain things, you know, and people to wonder, because it's sort of the obeying the maxim that you should always leave them wanting more. You know, it was a thing like apparently there's a story about Atticus and a goat in a Roman skirt, you know, and he never wanted to hear anybody tell that story. And so it never does get told. Mm-hmm. And I get people asking me, what was that? I'm like, I don't know. Atticus would never say so.
Yeah, it's and part of it is that, again, the fan fiction theory is maybe more fun and gratifying than anything you might have come up with for yourself. But there's also that old adage about wanting to have a lived-in feeling world. And I think part of what makes a character persuasively 800 years old in your mind, or persuasively, you know, lived in their world, is that they have so much history and so much sort of so many points of reference with themselves, with other characters, with their world, that you couldn't possibly hope to explain all of them. And to some extent, you don't even want to, because then it all becomes a sort of long-running, as you know, Bob-ish. Thing. These characters don't have a reason to explain their history back to themselves, and so why would they?
Yeah, this isn't a funny thing, but you know, I'm also a fan of the Dresden Files. There's there's two books out right now. I have not read them, so I don't know what's in them. But a few years ago, we got to talk to Jim Butcher, and one of the things that I pointed out to him, I said, there's a scene in X book where, you know, Harry clips his fingernails and his hair, and he lets Molly help him. And Molly takes the clippings away to destroy them.
Yeah.
But we never see her destroy them.
Ooh.
And it's such a big deal in Harry's universe. You don't leave pieces of yourself around.
Right.
Like in the past, whenever he's clipped fingernails or hairs or something, he's thrown it in a fireplace, right? He used to have the fireplace in the basement. He's always destroyed them. And in this case, he allowed Molly to take them. And I said, I don't trust Molly because she's getting in with the Fae now. And like, that just made me, I couldn't believe that Harry trusted and let her walk away. And now she has those, or maybe she doesn't. We don't know. And Jim just went, it's like, oh, you bastard.
Yeah, right. he likes the uncertainty and all that kind of stuff. That's great.
Yes. Yeah. Oh my God.
Love it.
Anyway, we're running a little long. Do we want to do picks of the week, Tracy?
Oh, sure. I'm all about it.
Sure.
Okay.
Picks of the week.
Kevin, do you have a pick?
Oh, I do.
Okay, do you want to go first?
Okay, sure. I believe that I probably on a previous show basically spoke about another book by this same author. But basically she's got two books out and I'm just over the moon about both of them. The first one is called The 10,000 Doors of January. And this is by Alix Harrow. And she spells her first name A-L-I-X. And then Harrow is H-A-R-R-O-W. The 10,000 Doors of January at this point has won a bunch of awards and gone into super multiple printings, and it's turbo successful for a very good reason. It's an amazing book. Now, her second book is not a sequel. It's just a completely different story on its own right. And it's called The Once and Future Witches, which I'm currently reading and loving. It's fantastic stuff where we have sort of three sisters who basically are going to form the sort of classic maiden, mother, crone, you know, triangle. And kind of bring about maybe a rebirth of witching in the world. And I love what it's doing. So I can highly recommend basically anything that Alix Harrow has written and will write in the future. It's just one of my favorite authors at the moment, and that would be my pick of the week. Go check out Alix Harrow's work, whether it's the first book or the second. You're going to enjoy it.
Fantastic.
Very cool.
Nice.
How about you, Tracy?
On a completely different end of the spectrum of things, listeners who've been hearing me for the last few months know that one of my COVID projects has been introducing my young nerdlings, my 13-year-old son and my 9-year-old daughter, to different sort of stuff from their nerd heritage, trying to show them cool movies or television shows and other sorts of things and kind of take their temperature on them. And part of the continuing quest, my husband pulled out the PlayStation 4 remaster of Medieval recently. For those of you who may not already be familiar with the game Medieval, the original version of it came out in the early 2000s. I believe it was a PlayStation 2 game, I think. I may be getting that wrong. But Medieval follows the story of the just recently revivified, but very much otherwise dead, knight who has been credited by history for felling the evil wizard who plagued the land some hundred odd years before. The problem is this is actually the problem is that someone else entirely killed the evil wizard, and just history got it wrong and gave this dude, who was sort of a random schmuck and not even a very talented knight, died in the first charge with an arrow through his eye, the credit for doing the thing he never did. And so in the video game Medieval, you are by mistake of sorcery and this mistake of history brought back to life as this skeletal version of yourself in a very sort of cartoony, clanky armor framework. It's very much from the sort of like ideological legacy of like the Sir Dirk games and things from in Dragon's Lair and things like that. That you have to go and quest around and destroy the minions of the evil wizard. And it's sort of dark and spooky, but more spoopy than it is spooky, if you know what I mean by that, and tremendously fun. So if you are interested in a game that's a bit of sort of a hack and slash explorer run around experience with a little bit of a sort of late fall vibe to it, check out Medieval.
Very cool.
That's awesome, yeah. So for my pick this week, one of the things that has kind of exploded during this pandemic time is delivery services, specifically Grubhub and DoorDash here in the States have gotten a lot of traction. I don't like either one of those because I discovered that a lot of restaurants lose money.
Yeah.
When you use those apps.
Yeah.
If you are going to order from a restaurant, the best way to do it is to go to their website and see if they have an order online function. It might use Grubhub or DoorDash, but when you go through their website, there's a distinction. There's a different line between going through their app, through the Grubhub and DoorDash app, and the restaurant is able to keep more money. So if you do have to use that, like that's one way to go. There's now a thing here, and I think it's just in Colorado. I hope that it grows and it goes a little bit beyond Colorado, but it's called NocoNash, N-O-C-O, or Nosh, N-O-C-O-N-O-S-H. It's up north right now. It's in Fort Collins and Boulder, but they're hoping to grow it. And this is a delivery service that's actually owned by the independent restaurants.
Mm.
So when you order through their app or through the websites of these independent restaurants, you actually, all the money gets kept by the restaurants and distributed somehow, some way. They don't specifically call out how that works, but the idea here is to kind of compete with DoorDash and Grubhub and have these local restaurants be able to offer delivery without having to give up all the money. One guy was talking about, if he has $1,000 worth of orders on Grubhub, he gets $600 from those orders. $1,000 worth of orders on NocoNash, he gets like $975. Like it's a ridiculous amount of money that he is able to keep for his restaurant. So I really like that. That's kind of my pick. I'm hoping that grows and that there's more opportunities for that across the country, because really Grubhub and DoorDash are terrible, terrible companies. They're even going so far as in, and I've mentioned this before, SEO is a thing that I do as a digital marketer. They are buying the keywords for restaurants that aren't participating in their app, and they're showing those restaurants as closed when you do Google searches.
Yes.
Even though the restaurants aren't actually closed.
I have encountered that very recently, actually. Like literally just 2 days ago, I went to order from a local Chinese carryout place that we like. And it came up as closed. And I ended up having to basically back channel Google it in a variety of different ways before I finally found their own website.
Yeah.
Jeez.
So definitely black hats. Don't like them. Anything that I can do to not. So I to be honest with you, I love delivery. It makes my life easier, but I've been doing more pickup lately. Whenever I do order from a restaurant, I will go to their website, find their website, see if they have, some of them have apps that are basically, point of sale things that are stripped down versions of a credit card checkout. But if they have something like that, I will use that. I will choose pickup, and then I'll go get it from the restaurant just because it helps them, you know, which is the point. We want to keep these restaurants and these people employed and able to survive this crap. And it still gets me a decent cooked meal that I don't have to cook myself. So there's my, I'll step down off my soapbox now.
All right.
Nice. All right. Well, it's been a heck of a podcast here, folks. I suspect that our listeners won't have much trouble finding the illustrious Kevin Hearn out there on the interwebs if they wanted to. But if we have someone who is Google impaired, how should they find you, Kevin Hearn?
I'm kevinhearn.com, and I spell my last name H-E-A-R-N-E. And then you can find me on Twitter, at Kevin Hearn, and also on Instagram, at Kevin Hearn. And I hope to see you guys, and I hope you enjoy Ink and Sigil. That's a great place to start. You do not have to read the Iron Druid Chronicles first to enjoy Ink and Sigil. You could dive in right there. And if you like epic fantasy, I've got my Seven Kennings series, which starts with A Plague of Giants. And if you like a humorous fantasy, then please begin with Kill the Farm Boy. And then I've got my sci-fi coming out next year. It's called A Question of Navigation, and you can look that up now and pre-order print if you would like. And, you know, ebook and audio will be later available closer to the actual release date in January. So Thank you guys so much for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us. It was great.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun as always.
Hey, we hope you enjoyed this episode of the Functional Nerds Podcast. If you're looking for other great podcasts to listen to, I recommend Beyond the Trope. They premiere new nerdy episodes every week. Giles and Michelle have piled up over 7 years worth of interviews with best-selling authors, award-winning actors, and other leaders in the creative community. And even though, I mean, they've sincerely disappointed me by not coordinating a meet and greet with every dog they know, their Patreon supporters and fans love them for keeping their weekly episodes short, sweet, and full of laughs. Check them out over at beyondthetrope.com. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, consider becoming a backer of the show over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. We have all new levels with some fantastic rewards like access to our patrons-only Facebook group, exclusive extra shows and content like the new video podcast, Just 10 Minutes, book giveaways, yep, we're giving away books, and even short story critiques provided by Tracy every month. If any of that sounds good to you, again, visit patreon.com/functionalnerds. This podcast is copyrighted by the Functional Nerds under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. To learn more about the Functional Nerds, visit functionalnerds.com.